initiative. I think it has failed miserably, and the fact that there has been no effective left for 30, 40 years, I mean, with the exception of these movements that I mentioned earlier, you know, the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn, Podemos in Spain, the Sanders moment, which arose out of Occupy. Mm-hmm. You haven't had established, institutionalized political parties that have taken on the problem of money in politics, growing inequality, and essentially the capture of liberal democratic institutions by the wealthy and powerful. Mm-hmm. What you have had are various forms of identity politics, you know, Black Lives Matter, for example, that has actually alienated a lot of people who have not been directly involved with it. It's alienated a lot of older African Americans in the United States. And there's an example that was raised by one of our speakers here at the Institute of Humanities a couple of years ago, Shama Savant, who you may have heard of. She was a two-term counselor at Seattle City Council. She ran under the Socialist Alternative banner. Mm-hmm. And unlike these populists, the left populists that I mentioned, who talk in kind of amorphous terms about, you know, about the many and the few, mm-hmm. Shama Savant actually appealed to people as workers, mm-hmm. which is very interesting. And she was responsible for raising the minimum wage of residents in Seattle, I think it was to $15. But she also brought in the Amazon tax, and the Amazon tax was essentially a tax placed on Amazon because it was moving its headquarters to the city, and there was a real concern that amidst rising property values and rents, this was only going to accelerate the problem. So Amazon was forced to pay property so-called Amazon tax to create a fund for social housing. Mm-hmm. Black Lives Matter, according to Shama in her lecture in Seattle, said that this isn't a black issue. And this, I think, is an example of precisely how identity politics really undermines a kind of class-based politics, which is really what we need in this historical moment when social economic inequality has gotten to such outrageously obscene levels. Mm-hmm. But identity politics has undermined this over and over and over again. That's why I'm real staunch critic of it. I think it's been absolutely deleterious for the left. And one only hopes now that Jeremy Corbyn's new party, party that he's just founded a couple of weeks ago, will take on this fight for greater, just equity, but actual socioeconomic equality via meaningful wealth redistribution through things like, you know, a progressive tax system.
Mm-hmm. I mean, with identity politics, I am kind of critical of it too, I will say, because like it's kind of gotten out of hand more so. And now I want to ask about this question. So when we see the US and Europe show support for Israel, especially Germany, it is seen as like a moral obligation rooted in Holocaust memory. Yet critics say that this support has turned it into a justification for ignoring Israel's violation of human rights. How would you interpret this moral dilemma that Europe and the United States have when they claim they support Jewish people, but at the end of the day, they don't really like care enough about it?
Yeah, this is a huge question. I think in the German context, Angela Merkel made clear in 2008, I think it was, that support for Israel was Germany's Staatsraison. So yes. It's essentially the reason for Germany's existence was to support Israel as a way of making amends for what the Nazis subjected the Jewish people to during the Second World War. And one can certainly understand this reasoning. At the same time, does this mean that anything and everything that Israel does is acceptable? It cannot mean this. Yet, you have Germany's most famous philosopher, Jürgen Habermas, signed a letter which, amongst other things, said that one cannot attribute genocidal intentions to the state of Israel. Why not? I mean, there seems to be mounting evidence that this is exactly what's going on, that there is intent to destroy whole or in part Palestinian people through forced starvation, through downright murder, extermination. There's building of concentration camps. There's a targeting of children in particular. Hospitals, institutions of higher education, targeting of journalists, etc. Right? So I think one has to weigh the evidence. And it's up to, for example, the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court, to deliberate and come to a judgment. For Germany to stand against South Africa before the ICJ, I think is offensive, given Germany's own genocidal history prior to the Holocaust in Southern Africa. The fact that there was a Berlin conference in 1884-85, which led to the divvying up of the African continent and so-called scramble for Africa. So the state has quite a temerity, I think, to stand shoulder to shoulder with Israel against South Africa and its case against Israel, or its case that Israel is engaged in genocidal actions in Gaza against the Palestinian people. There's a subtler problem here too, which isn't recognized as much as it should be, and that is that you have a paradox here, that what Germany is atoning for is its radically exclusionary notion of who is and isn't a German, right? Because in the 20th century, the Jewish community was most integrated amongst all European societies, in German society. Right? The Nazis came along and sought to excise Jews from German society. So Holocaust memory is about the memory of, amongst other things, that initial process of exclusion, the Nuremberg laws, which subsumed Jews within a category of second-class citizenship, so on and so forth, all the way to the point where extermination was the final solution to the Jewish problem, right? Holocaust memory, in a way, does something similar insofar as you have migrants coming to Germany in the post-war, to West Germany in the post-war period, to help build the society up out of the rubble, out of the ruins, which contributed to the so-called Wirtschaftswunder, the German miracle, right, the economic miracle. But there is no way those so-called guest workers, Gastarbeiter, coming from Anatolia, largely, and then later, you know, other waves of migrant labor coming into the country, those essentially immigrants to German society, could not identify with those historical those negative historical experiences, and therefore were by definition excluded mm-hmm. from membership in the German nation, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And you can then see where that might go, especially with the AfD hovering mm-hmm. in the wings,
mm-hmm.
right? So this memory culture is highly paradoxical. One understands it, mm-hmm. right? But and it, you know, it is something that in some ways Canada hasn't gone through. The United States certainly hasn't reckoned with its past, as I mentioned mm-hmm. earlier. Right? It hasn't really reckoned with the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
That's why, you know, the various generals who lost the war on the side of the Confederacy are still lauded in the South. These are heroes.
Yeah.
They're not seen as traitors.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there's that wound that hasn't been healed. And the Germans have in contrast, done an enormous labor to coming to terms with the past. But those paradoxes of memory
mm-hmm.
remain. Maybe when it was initially articulated, there was a notion that Germany is not a society of migration, right? Mm-hmm. And that was the dominant notion for a long time,
mm-hmm.
but that has changed,
mm-hmm.
right? And so that memory culture needs to change in tandem,
mm-hmm.
right? It can't be based on a kind of genealogical tie to the past. It must be based on something a little different.
Mm-hmm.
What that might look like, I don't know. But at present, this is a paradox, which is also leading to very unfortunate scenes of returning German Jews who are anti-Zionist, so some of whom would be the great grandsons and great-granddaughters of Holocaust survivors, German Holocaust survivors, European Holocaust survivors, they are being brutalized mm-hmm. by the German state because they're critical of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, I mean, Germany has enthusiastically embraced the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, which critics argue equates criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
So you can be an anti-Zionist and, you know, an anti-Zionist critic of Israel as a Jew mm-hmm. and be labeled anti-Semitic.
Mm-hmm.
There's something wrong with this, especially when articulating that kind of a position gets you a baton over the head in a street demonstration
yeah.
for Palestinian lives.
Mm-hmm. I feel like Germany is kind of applying its guilt too rigidly, because I've kind of paid attention to what the German media was saying, and they mentioned this thing called imported anti-Semitism from the Middle East. And I want to like say, is Germany really applying it too rigidly? Because we have people like Friedrich Merz, their like new chancellor, who says that like this is important anti-Semitism. And ironically enough, the AfD also says the same thing, despite them being notoriously authoritarian and you know, having this whole historical revisionism. Do you agree that it's being applied too rigidly?
I think so, and I think what might be at issue here, and this brings us back to the earlier part of our discussion, that is that even when politicians aren't explicitly populist in this authoritarian sense, in an exclusionary sense, they can tend still to convey or play with populist tropes. And I think today in Europe there is, and there has been for some time, growing Islamophobia,
mm-hmm.
And you see this also, you know, amongst, you know, right-wing commentators in North America, and this has been the case for some time now. Kind of anxiety, and again, it goes back to kind of demographic anxiety of so-called Eurabia, right?
Mm-hmm.
Europe is becoming increasingly dominated by Muslims, Islamic immigration,
mm-hmm.
and you know, there's this is just being whipped up by, for example, the English Defence League in the United Kingdom,
mm-hmm.
whose politics are not that far removed from UKIP reform, which is, before you know it, we're going to have the imposition of Sharia law
yeah.
on society.
That's like their boogeyman, I'm assuming.
Yeah, exactly. So this is also part and parcel, then, of the defence of Israel as a kind of last bastion, or maybe not the last bastion, the sort of first bastion of European civilization in the very heart of the Muslim world.
They call it the only democracy in the Middle East.
They do, but I mean, who can really say that with a straight face these days?
I'm quite critical of what they're doing, and I don't really agree with this whole notion that it's a democracy, because even if it is, it doesn't really give them an excuse to do this sort of thing.
Definitely not. You would expect democracies to abide by international law.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly, Israel has not done so. It hasn't
yeah.
done so at least since 1967. Maybe the founding of Israel itself pushes against some of the norms of the global
mm-hmm.
international order.
And in your interview that you sent me previously, you were talking about the brutality of anti-Zionist Jews that they were experiencing in primarily U.S. and Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Germany has been probably like the most strict country in terms of pro-Palestine demonstrations. And does this like show concerns of free speech protections being applied unevenly? Because like I've seen people who are Zionists being defended, while those critical of it were silenced, arrested, and including Jewish people themselves. So does this also like kind of showcase Germany's poor handling of their history?
Well, right. I think any reckoning with that country's fascist past must entail a very strong defense of liberal democracy, and central to liberal democracy is freedom of thought, expression, freedom of speech, academic freedom. And Germany seems to be failing over and over again. I mean, one example is Nancy Fraser. I don't know if this name means anything to you, but she's a very important critical theorist. Political theorist. She herself is a Jewish American.
Mm-hmm.
And she had been invited to be a fellow, I think it was at the University of Cologne. And the university became aware of the fact that she had simply signed on to a pro-Palestinian petition or letter. And they revoked the invitation. I mean, this is an egregious breach of academic freedom. And this
mm-hmm.
is an American Jew
mm-hmm.
Who has been a key interlocutor with the philosopher I mentioned earlier,
mm-hmm.
Jürgen Habermas. And the community of scholars around him, but she's been disinvited, and I think this is absolutely reprehensible.
I feel like there are also like anti-Semites who do support Israel. Is that true? I've heard like talks about like actual anti-Semites like supporting Israel, but like being anti-Semitic.
Of course. I mean, you know, a couple of cases in point. I mean, Viktor Orban, the notorious anti-Semite,
mm.
who passed a law that essentially forced George Soros's
university?
Central European University out of the country.
This was
referred to as a Soros law, and it was done so under the guise of Soros being a key globalist.
Mm.
That is a key word or a secret word, a dog whistle, let's say, term for powerful, wealthy Jew. Yet, Orban is very good buddies with Bibi Netanyahu.
Yeah.
And once the attack happened on October 7th, 2023, Marine Le Pen said that outside of Israel, the Jews would be safest in France. Her father, Marie Le Pen, who was key leader of the Front National, which is a predecessor, of course, to the rally, once remarked that the Holocaust was but a footnote to the Second World War. So here you have, and I don't expect his daughter to have dramatically changed her perspective on Jews and the historical experience of Jewish suffering, but she is a staunch supporter of Israel. And you see this over and over and over again, right? Where notorious anti-Semites evince support for Israel.
I feel like with Israel's case, it's treated like it's a country that is like so special to everyone. And the United States has done a good job with defending Israel by like including laws that bans Americans from criticizing Israel, and they hold it to a higher account than Americans themselves. Is this like how would you describe that?
Well, I mean, here one has to simply look at the facts, and those facts show, and one can find these facts on its very website, that AIPAC, the American Israel Political Affairs Committee, has done a very successful job of lobbying U.S. lawmakers, and also threatening those who challenge and criticize Israel. And the way they do that is by funding their opponents in elections, in primaries, and so on. And they show this. It's not any kind of a conspiracy. It's very clear. They're very proud of this, and you can see it on their website.
Yeah.
So this is something that has to be reckoned with in terms of the inordinate influence that another state has on the United States and its policies and its laws and its funding priorities. And I think this is a key point for all those who are concerned about the rise of anti-Semitism. I definitely am. I think it's a very serious problem, which is why I gave the example of 2017 and the slogan, "Jews will not replace us." I think this lies at the heart of so much far-right discourse today. But I think that now we've seen this massive tax cut to the ultra-wealthy, which is going to lead to cuts to Social Security, to Medicaid, and other programs, food stamps, etc. There's going to be enormous suffering and indeed death as a result of this. Once these cuts kick in, people are going to suffer, people are going to die as hospitals either minimize their services or cut their services or are closed altogether. Right? There's going to be a lot of suffering, and you already have these far-right commentators like Nick Fuentes, but also those who are sort of on the right of the Republican Party, Marjorie Griffin Taylor, for example, and others who are starting to connect the dots for people. While billions of dollars keep being funneled to Israel as a result, in part, of the efforts of AIPAC.
Mm-hmm.
While ordinary Americans, indeed Trump supporters, many of them, I'd say the majority of them, are going to face unimaginable horrors with these cuts.
Mm-hmm.
I think that will lead to a massive, massive spike in anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something so incredibly unjust about this. I mean, anti-Semitism itself is a very dangerous, as we know, pernicious prejudice. But you can imagine all those anti-Zionist Jews who have unfailingly,
mm-hmm.
unflaggingly, tirelessly criticized the state of Israel and this mm-hmm. government in particular,
mm-hmm.
especially with respect to it's not a war. It has to be named as the extermination of mm-hmm. Palestinians in Gaza, and also, I mean, the continuing displacement occupation of the mm-hmm. West Bank. They will feel,
mm-hmm.
in an incredibly unjust way, the impact
mm-hmm.
of the anti-Semitism that will skyrocket as a result of these two facts.
Mm-hmm.
Massive cutbacks to citizens,
mm-hmm.
incredible wealth transfer to the ultra-rich,
mm-hmm.
and continuing transfers of wealth
mm-hmm.
to fund the killing machine
mm-hmm.
in Gaza.
Yeah.
To what end, American citizens will ask, to what end?
Mm-hmm. I feel like, okay, I wanted to include this last part, and this is from Israel themselves, because they like to use the Holocaust as a justification for what they're doing, and many European countries have continued to bring up the Holocaust as a way to basically, like, give Israel the go-to to continue doing this. And I've seen Holocaust survivors even criticize Israel because they see the parallels between history. Do you agree that, you know, using the Holocaust as this is just, like, at this point, the lowest Israel could go?
I think this is absolutely right, that to use Jewish suffering in general, which stretches back millennia,
mm-hmm.
but the suffering in particular of the victims and the survivors of the Holocaust is really to do a kind of secondary violence
mm-hmm.
To those who suffered, to those who died, to those who lost family members,
mm-hmm.
To those who had to bear the torments of concentration camps.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, there's a great German philosopher, Immanuel Kant, who said one must always treat rational beings as ends in themselves,
mm-hmm.
never as means.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think when you treat the victims and survivors of the Holocaust in this way, you're not treating them as ends, you're treating them as means.
Mm-hmm.
Means to the worst kind of realpolitik that you can imagine. The decimation of the Palestinian mm-hmm. people. So that gives us some pause, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess that's all I have. Thank you for the question, for the answers on the questions.
My pleasure.
Volunteering at CJSF 90.1 FM is a great experience and is easy to get started. So I'll tell you a little bit about it in the hope that you reach out. As this station is run almost entirely by volunteers, you have a variety of ways to get active at CJSF. Every department can use a little bit of help. Arts and entertainment. Well, you can write and produce reviews, conduct interviews of local musicians, the music library, acquiring, organizing, reviewing, and compiling charts. Public affairs. Interviewing groups, attending events, recording lectures. Public relations, postering, graphic design, and programming. You can host your own show or work on a collective. Production, audio editing, and PSA building. And once you feel comfortable, you can even volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca.